jazz.
Busted.
Well, are we ready for the new stuff? Are we ready to
go
here?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Let's see. What number could this be? Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 166. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
And hopefully, Mike, like these selections, or I'll have to title the podcast. You got some splainin' to do. we'll see. I think only one of them is I like them all, but one of them is odd. Anyway, we both get review copies from time to time, and I thought it was time to do a show of just brand new stuff. And in fact, three of these releases are not out yet. We're going to be doing Jerry Gibbs' Our People. It's out June 7th. Lauren Desberg's Out for Delivery, which drops June 5th. Joss Espinoza's trio's Journey into Night, which comes out June 14th. And the Joe Policastro trio, Nothing Here Belongs, which has come out February 8th. So it's the only one that's on, I don't want to say store shelves, but I guess on the internet at this time. So those are the four selections. I'd like to do the trios together. Other than that, I really don't have an agenda. Do you have a preference?
Nope. Fine by me.
Okay. Well, my thought is maybe we'll do the trios and then look at Our People and then end with Out for Delivery, because we always have lots of things to say about vocalists. So both these trios interest me because I think they're both examples of young musicians reaching out at least a little bit from the known jazz repertoire to other music. And so they're by no means albums of covers. Mostly it's original stuff in both of them, but both sessions do include a couple less common pop songs in their run-up. So let's begin with Joss Espinoza. His trio is comprised of himself on piano, Mikhail Coombs on bass, and Jaron Davis on drums. And currently he's working as an adjunct faculty member at the Peabody Institute of Johns Hopkins University as Mr. Espinoza. He teaches jazz piano lessons to non-jazz majors, and in the summers he appears at Interlochen Arts Camp. So this is a jazz piano trio. And it starts off with a song that we might remember from the 80s, even though I realized, oh, yeah, that's really a 60s song. But I don't know, when you listen to always something there to remind me, to me, it did not bring back thoughts of Bacharach as much as the 80s cover of that song. So
who
what are your thoughts
about
this? Who did
the 80s cover, anyway?
What's that?
Who did the 80s cover?
Oh, it's some weird, obscure... Yeah, I mean, somebody that, even when I looked them up, I did not recognize their name. So clearly, they're kind of obscure. Let's see here. Naked Eyes. I never heard of the band Naked Eyes, but I certainly heard their cover of Always Something There to Remind Me in the 80s growing up.
Wow. Okay. I know the song, and I had no idea that was... I'd never heard of them. I mean, I honestly can't say that I've ever heard of them. I mean, I must have heard that song, but... I mean,
exactly.
I know I've heard that song.
Yeah,
okay.
not a group that rings any bells from that period of time. And we both went through it, and we both know many of the groups. But yeah, Diana Warwick did it. It's a Bacharach song. That's where he leads off the album, and then it goes into a number of original things. So what do you think of this trio album, Piano Trio?
So I like this, but I feel like the giant looming shadow of the Brad Meldow trio just lurks everywhere here. And maybe that's just my ears. You know, maybe Joshua Espinoza has never heard Brad Meldow and his trio doesn't care at all about Meldow stuff. But it feels to me that like a jazz piano trio, that's just a voice they have to reckon with. And it feels, this feels to me a lot like something that's struggling with the anxiety of influence of the Meldow trio a little bit. I like it. I don't feel the selection of pop material reminds me of the selection of pop material that Meldow's trios often get up to. I dig the sound on this in terms of the balance. I think they've done a really nice job of, it's a trio. It's not Espinoza and two supporting cast members. This really feels like a trio, which the Meldow trio at its best often feels like three voices, you know, kind of simultaneously doing something. And my apologies to Joshua Espinoza and his band if someone obsessed with Meldow just hears Meldow everywhere when he listens to this trio, but I kind of do. I feel like it's a good deal funkier than Meldow stuff, not nearly as white sounding. He also tends to be, just in general on this album, a little more major key, a little less dark and ruminative, a little more peppy or poppy. A couple of the songs I really kind of liked that kind of stood out for me. The choice of There's Always Something There to Remind Me was pretty good. I kind of like that. I thought what I take to be originals here are kind of the most interesting songs in some ways. I don't know if Streetlight Serenade is an original, but I like that cut quite a bit. And I liked Nocturne for Anne-Marie a good deal. It's kind of, you know, it's a nocturne. It's kind of this sweet contemplative thing, but it has a really neat shift after the statement of the opening melody that I found kind of compelling and interesting. The song Unwelcome Dream has a lot of really nice melodic play for the bass player in that, which I dug. I thought that was pretty good. And again, I'm not sure. I didn't have any information on this, or if I got it, I deleted it. So I don't know what's an original and what's, you know, a cover. And then Birdsong was a nice surprise as well. Because in jazz, if you have a song with the word bird in it, you are just predisposed. You are conditioned to think, okay, here comes some Charlie material. Here comes some Parker material. And for once, a song called, you know, with the words bird and song in it seems to have absolutely nothing to do with Charlie Parker. It's just this really pleasant major key kind of jeu d'esprit. It sort of feels like a little Sesame Street video of someone feeding pigeons. I just dug it. I thought it was really neat. So the cuts here that stuck out as kind of originals, I kind of liked, or that I thought might be originals. So that for me, that would be the Nocturne, Streetlight Serenade, Unwelcome Dream, and Birdsong. The covers, they're okay. None of them knocked my socks off. I thought they were okay. I liked Shenandoah. I thought that's an interesting cover, although I've heard a few jazz covers of that by now. In my life, we've heard plenty of Beatles jazz covers. A-Train, fine. Desperado, I actually have heard a jazz cover or two of that song, but it was nice. So in general, my feeling about this album is kind of positive, but I don't have a real solid feel for what these guys do. I guess maybe I would have liked, I liked the originals here, or the things that I thought were originals. I might have wanted to hear more of those things. What do you think?
Yeah, I guess I didn't necessarily think of the great Brad listening to this. One thing that happens when you do covers, and I'm happy to see that this album has some covers, and some of them, I mean, obviously Take the A-Train is a definition of a war horse, so it's a great song, but some of these other ones are not as commonly done. But then you're kind of putting yourself up as a curator.
Right.
And yeah, I don't, you know, I've heard Diana Krall do Desperado, I've heard this version. I'm still not convinced it's a great song.
Yeah.
I don't like the Eagles that much, period. And that particular example of their art is not one that galvanizes me, but there it is. I mean, if nothing else, it is taking a jazz look at music that is now really fairly old. It's been around for decades, but not the usual suspects, not right. The popular music of the 50s and the 40s and the 30s. It's the 70s. So that seems to me like a good thing. Again, I'm not sure that, you know, Shenandoah, not my favorite song.
I've heard a few covers of this by now.
I don't know that I have. Okay, yeah.
Oh, Bill Frisell absolutely has one.
That's
somewhere.
True, and that's a good, right. You know, anytime you get Americana, you start thinking. And, I like this group overall. I think it's, as you say, good sound, a good balance in the trio. I'd say it's maybe a little soft-edged for me. I mean, it's not trying to startle you. I certainly didn't get that sense of the drilling down of the analytical kind of obsessiveness that you get with a Meldow, for better or for worse, and sometimes it's for better. But
yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean,
this is pleasant. This isn't. Right. I didn't have that sense of striving, but you know, it seemed to. Yeah, you know, it didn't have that soaring I'm not trying to insult anyone. It didn't have the kind of soaring uber ambition that you sometimes get with, you know, trios. But that's not to diminish it with faint praise. I thought it was very good of its kind. It's very good at what it sets out to do. You know, 3.5 stars.
Yeah, and to me, it's a heartening sign that we're hopefully getting to a generation of musicians that are more comfortable with this idea that you've got to go out there and find music. And of course, it's getting harder every day because we have less of a kind of a common well to draw from. But I think that's one of many reasons that 70s classic rock has become kind of canonized, is that it was a period of time when there was a kind of hegemony of, you know, the radio. A lot of people heard these songs. And now, you know, what is the sound of 2000 or 2010? I mean, one, you've got the issue of the last couple of decades have been dominated by rap, which is its own challenge for jazz musicians to adapt to. And then now you've got the silos of just, you know, anybody can listen to whatever they want. So there's less of a common kind of a culture out there. But most people living have in America have heard the Eagles. So play a song by them or the Beatles. You know, there's going to be some recognition there. But it's not, again, the old stuff. So I was kind of excited to see that. I thought this was successful. I would have preferred a little more edge to it, not necessarily the Meldow kind, but just, you know, something that challenged me a little bit harder. But
just, you know, something that marked it out is, you know, we're going to talk about a trio next that definitely has, like, their own sound, like an identifiable sound, you know.
And it's tough. I mean, right.
Yeah. I don't feel like, and maybe it's just, you know, if I'd listened to 10 albums by the Joshua Espinosa Trio, I'd go, oh, yeah, it's that thing they do. Right, but I don't have that thing they do yet. Right.
Absolutely, and I'm absolutely there. I mean, in other words, that this is very fine piano jazz, but both of us right now, where we are listening to it, it's not strikingly eccentric or original. It's good, but it doesn't have a fingerprint for us, and partially that's because, you know, what, 80%, 90% of jazz musicians are playing in a tradition, and you have to kind of get to know them as individuals. And then there's the 10% of the 20% that are just very idiosyncratic or distinctive or paradigm shifting that you get right away. I mean, nobody mistakes Thelonious Monk after the first couple of albums. You know, you kind of know what he's about. It's very distinctive. But, you know, mostly people are more, and this is not meant to be insulting, generic sounding, especially when you haven't got to know him yet. But, you know.
Yeah. So I like this, but I don't. It didn't set my hair on fire. I liked it.
Yeah, I was always, you know, when I taught, I always had this feeling that at the beginning of a semester, my classes always seemed uglier to me than they did at the end. And it was, they weren't humans yet. You know, I was looking at them as aesthetic objects or something. And most of us, including me, you know, we don't look like movie stars in the mirror. And then after a few weeks, it didn't matter because you knew them as individuals. And some of them were kind of pain in the butts and assholes, but mostly you kind of knew where they were coming from. And they started to have some individuality, and it started to be a person rather than something you're looking at that was, you know, vaguely threatening because you're going to have to please them for 50 minutes three times a week. So, yeah, it's a little bit that way, I think, with new jazz musicians. You know, you're trying to, what's this person about? But, yeah, anyway, I'd recommend it. I think it's a good record. The next trio is a guitar-based ensemble. Joe Palacastro is a drummer. No, I'm sorry, is a bass player. I'm sorry, Joe. Forgive me. Mikel Avery is on drums, and Dave Miller is on guitar. And this is a group out of Chicago, and we have a bias towards Chicago, though I did not know it till looking up the notes recently. But I did like this group. So this is the one that's out, Nothing Here Belongs, by the Joe Palacastro Trio. Thoughts about this one?
Yeah, this really grabbed me. I like this quite a bit. Just a whole bunch of things worked really well here for me. It opens and closes with covers, and they're good.
Right.
They're really well chosen. Starting with Springsteen's I'm on Fire is a terrific idea. And it's not just because it's an interesting song. Their take on it is interesting. And I could listen to that song a lot. I really like their take on it. And then they close with This Must Be the Place, the Talking Heads number. And it's fucking awesome. I love that song, first of all. And then as a jazz cover, it's just fantastic. So what's interesting about this trio is the guitarist gets just a lot of room to run, but it's still pretty clearly Joe Palacastro's group. He's a hell of a bass player, and even though the guitar gets a lot of room to run, he gets a lot of soloing space. There are really cool spots where the bass player and the drummer kind of get in there and do some fun stuff. So like the I'm on Fire starts out kind of, you know, peppy jazz, and then it just kind of rocks out. We get sort of like fuzzed out guitar, you know, in a number of places, which is just fantastic. I just think that it's really clever. Is Speak Slow, who is that by? Is that an original? And it's got to be a cover, right?
Speak Slow. I couldn't tell you, and I don't.
They have a song called Speak Slowly, but L-Y yeah. in parentheses, and I thought that must be an allusion to another song.
Well,
and
I don't know. I guess Speak Low would be the candidate, but.
Yeah, so anyway, for a song called Speak Slowly, it's brisk as fuck, which is kind of clever. The other song on here, so the opener and closer, I just adore. I think they're fantastic. I thought Bloodshot, the third number, was really cool. It's kind of a slow burn funk thing, and it kind of builds. It's stylish and appealing, just super cool. It's just, if you were looking for the oral tag, for, you know, to say, what is something that's cool? You could play this song and you'd be like, this is cool. It just sort of radiates coolness. I really like this song quite a bit. There's a couple of songs I don't quite get that much. I thought were really a little weird. In the middle, there's a trio of songs in the middle that I didn't grok any of them. In the Quiet, and then The Wandering Sea, which is kind of fuzzed guitar over bass and drums, and it's kind of bossa or something. And then it builds, and then the guitar kind of gets fuzzed out a little bit toward the end. And then Oceans of Notions, which I can't quite figure out either.
I kind of like that one, yeah. It's kind of cute.
Well, it alternates between a basic melody and then odd little interpolations, you know?
Yeah.
And I never quite got a feel for that song. But then Plain Song is a nice builder. I always like slow crescendos, and that song kind of builds slowly. And No Idea also, I thought, was pretty good as well. So for me, this was like a sandwich. It was like a BLT on toast, crunchy edges, and a little soft in the middle. But yeah, I like this, and I just think the guitarist and the bass player here work really well together. I mean, they're kind of the featured members here, although Mikel Avery's drums clearly are kind of the anchor for the two of these guys. But yeah, this is a really good partnership, and these guys have recorded a bunch already, I think. So it sort of shows. It feels like there's a real kind of rapport here between the two lead voices. So yeah, I like this a lot. This is easily my favorite of this week. I'd look for anything by this trio at this point, because I like this album so much. I thought it was very good.
Yeah, I was very impressed with it too. It's guitarists in the jazz realm. They're, you know, one route is the kind of Jim Hall and to a lesser extent Grant Green pure tone route. And then the question is how much funk do you put into it, how much abstraction? And then, you know, we had that generation of Metheny, Schofield, and Frizzell, and you know, Frizzell is probably the one that's evoked the most here, where they changed their tones. They each had very distinctive tones. Here, you know, there's almost some country and western, a little plucking going on.
Yeah.
As you say, distortion comes in. I don't know that I've quite got his signature sound in my head, but they're willing to kind of play their instruments in a way that is not certainly evocative of a straight jazz trio a la the 50s. But it's still clearly jazz, clearly a lot of improvisation going on, a lot of interaction. Boy, when they picked their covers, they were not the usual suspects. I mean, it wasn't the low-hanging fruit. You know, if I'm thinking, nope, who do you cover in a jazz group, I'm probably not thinking the Talking Heads or Springsteen. You know, Elvis Costello, maybe.
And not early Talking Heads. I'd pick something later, right, with the more African polyrhythm stuff, not the right earlier.
Well, I mean, that's, you
simpler
know,
things.
Speaking in tongues, I think of as middle, I guess. I mean, it's right post Eno, but yeah, it's not like Naked. It's not, or even Remain in Light, which is earlier, but is more amenable to covers. Yeah, it's I think it works. I think it works great. And I was just listening to 77 today. I hadn't listened to that album for years. And I was reminded how much it was about the propulsion and the rhythm of the guitar early on. Yeah, so interesting choices. And my theory is if they show that these songs work as jazz, there's so many, Wham! There's just so many groups that Steely Dan, half of what they ever did, that would be much easier to kind of put into this idiom. I guess my point would be it's a little more, though, I'd say always something that remind me is distinctive. But here they're really showing a little more about kind of creative sideways thinking in terms of what they picked to play. But yeah, I thought there was good energy to the group. It was a little bit more in your face. This is not a dissonant group. This is not Albert Eiler or something, but they're just a little bit more willing to draw attention to what they're doing, to have hot transients, to have sounds that kind of perk up your ears. Rather than, you know, something is smoothly flowing that can easier slip in the background. So I like that. But yeah, I thought it was a good group. I know we're Chicago homers, but at the time I listened to it, I didn't know they were. But they are in the Chicago area, so I definitely go out and see them if I got a chance. Again, I just like the mix of originals. Mostly it's originals here, but the covers really stand out because they're so unusual and they're so creative. So strong recommendation. Well, are we ready to put on our big boy pants and brace ourselves here? Because this next selection is the one I thought I might get in trouble for. I find it oddly fascinating.
Good. You can explain one, why you picked it, and you have some explaining to do. I listened to this and I go ahead. Tell the class what we're listening to and talking about.
I have some explaining to do. So I heard this and I think it was a track where the sum total of the lyrics was, "Oh yeah, oh yeah," that I said, yeah, we got to talk about this. This is the Jerry Gibbs group. And apparently Jerry's a very successful musician in his own right. He's played sessions. He's a drummer. And
son of Terry Gibbs, the vibraphonist.
And anyway, apparently legendary pianist Billy Childs asked Gibbs, who'd had many chart successes in the jazz realm, "Why don't you make your next album Doing Whatever You Want?" And clearly he does. This is called Our People. It comes out June 7th. And the promo materials play up the fact that there are five musicians playing 80 instruments or something like that. It's crazy. So Alex Collins is the keyboardist. He also plays marimba vibes, soprano, and alto saxophone, acoustic guitar, accordion, lead and background vocals, and percussion. And he's the main soloist on this. Gianluca Renzi performs all bass and string parts, as well as background vocals and miscellaneous percussion. Jerry Gibbs recorded all percussion parts, as well as auxiliary percussion, glockenspiel, electronic soundscapes, keyboards, and some vocals. And he also engineered, composed this, and mixed it. And then there's guests Mayu Seke, who performed all woodwind parts, which confuses me because I think of the saxophone as a woodwind. Maybe they meant clarinet and oboe. I don't know. Vocals and percussion. And Kieshe Gibbs, who contributed the majority of the vocal parts and some percussion. So this is like an over an hour epic called Our People. And do you have any comments? Am I on my own here? Other than
Here are my comments. So, you know, Jerry Gibbs has kind of made a name for himself with his interest in fusion and the Big Weather Report tribute and so forth. I don't get this. And frankly, I don't like it. There's some really fine playing on this. So like, you know, like on Oh Yeah, the keyboard solo is crazy. It's like really good. Like, the playing here is really good, but I don't understand what this is about. I don't really like it very much. I'm not particularly taken with the vocals. It feels like fusion crossed with elevator music. I don't like this. And when it came on, I would, you know, wince. I would sort of cringe and be like, God damn it, you know, but I'd listen. I don't like this very much. So can you explain to me what the hell is going on? Like, what am I not getting? Like, it seems as if when you call something Our People, you know, and the cover art that this has, it has an agenda of some kind. And I'm not catching the agenda. I don't get the agenda. I don't understand what's happening here. And I'm not particularly blown away by, I'm impressed with the music, but I am not, it, like some of the best fusion, you know, I stand in awe, but I remain emotionally untouched by it. And that's how I feel about most of this. So tell me, explain yourself.
Well, let's try to justify myself. Yeah, I just found this fascinating. I don't know that it's my favorite record ever, but I do think, and I've gone on and on about this, and people are sick of hearing about it. I'm going to keep going on about it. I think the imagery with it and the title is extremely dissonant to what's happening. To me, it's like, this is about space people. This is about aliens. This has nothing to do with the, you know, I mean, like our people, yeah, if they all had antennae, sure. I mean, it seems a very otherworldly space opera, rather than you look at that and you think, oh, this is going to be some kind of ethnomusical celebration of, I don't know, earthy culture across, you know, you assume
like it's going some sort of anti-Trump screed or something, you know?
Right, which, you know, I mean, this may have some coded messages about him. You know, maybe if you play Oh Yeah backwards, it says Trump sucks, Trump sucks, Trump sucks, Trump sucks. It does in my mind anyway. Yeah, it's just, it's wild. It's one of those things where it's like, turn it up to 11. He's like, no, I think 13 is where we're going to put it. Just kind of endlessly climbing chord progressions. It's always like it's a rocket ready to take off. It's like Return to Forever took some cocaine, which is scary to think about because I thought they already had, but they took some more. The synth textures, I don't know. Is there a setting on the synth called McMillan and Wife? I've always wondered. Is there? And I mean, when I say this, I'm not trying to like mock it. It's just like there's a happy synth setting.
For anyone not our age, you'll need to explain that reference.
There's a show called McMillan and Wife. And the weird thing is when I watched it in repeats, it's like, no, I remember this really hooky synth line with this real high sine wave kind of sound. And I don't find it again. Anyway.
And tell the class who was the star of McMillan and Wife.
The irrefutably heterosexual Rock Hudson, right?
That is correct. That is correct.
And he had a wife, and
who
she,
no one remembers. I don't remember who that
oh,
was.
Oh, she was cool. She was like Susan St. James. Anyway,
that's what I was going to guess, but I don't. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Anyway, but there was a in the '70s there was a synthesizer that would play these. And it, yeah, this album is all in on the synths. I mean, it really,
oh, yeah.
it put,
Big
it's
time.
Like all the chips are down the synth. And it just seems very eccentric and personal to me. It does sound like an album where he just did whatever the fuck he wanted to do. And that was to please his masters in space. And it's cool. I mean, I can't explain what he's after or what it's about. I mean, I think I like most of this. I think it's a lot of fun, but it's very much in its own world. And, you know, I just don't know whether if you had some more organic sounds in there, just for contrast, it would work better because so much of it, I know there are saxophones and whatnot, but for the most part, this is really, and there's some amazing keyboard work. You know, the drumming is excellent. The production is very well done.
Oh, yeah. I got no beef with the playing. The playing is fantastic. My beef is the same beef I have with certain fusion, which is, what's this in honor of? I don't have an emotional connection to this.
And to me, it was a kind of almost helium-infused optimism or just kind of energy. It's not of this earth. You know, it's not.
It's a very white Sun Ra album, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, though, there's really no dissonance here. I mean, we want to be clear. No. Of course, we always play clips. But yeah, this is not music that is challenging in that sense. It's just you think, oh, you can't go there. And he's like, oh, I'm fucking going there.
It's challenging. It challenges your patience is what it challenges.
Well, I mean, it's just, you know, like, but you're not going to make the next chord even higher than the last one, are you? He's like, fuck, yes, I am. You know, it's going up. But you're done now. You're going to go down. No, I'm still going up, motherfucker. You know, it's just like, okay, we're on this rocket. You know, it's this rocket of enthusiasm. It's a small world after all, plus, I don't know, Return to Forever, plus what sounded like about a pound of cocaine. It's weird. I mean, there's some dedications to musicians he likes, you know, wants to check. And it is, again, it's this epic thing where it ends with, it's kind of the old style theme album or whatever you want to call it. You know, it's a concept album that clearly has a beginning, middle, and an end. But it's not about dirty, regular bluesy human emotions. It's about, I feel, meeting our friends in space and finding a new civilization where everything is squeaky clean. I don't know. Nothing like what the cover seems to imply. I enjoyed it, but there's an audacity about it, I guess, that is just kind of mind-blowing to me. And I don't know what niche this is aimed for. And I think it's more about what he wanted to do. Because even, you know, I really enjoyed, I think more than you did, Eight Ball City by Kenner. But that, to me, one, it was also half an hour. But it also just seemed to, like, have touchstones that were more familiar. And, you know, it was probably a little bit more musically varied. And I think in some ways a more successful project. But this is, it's really creates its own world. It's kind of a weird world. And it's a lot of musical strands and emotions are absent from it, as you said. I don't know if I want to call it white, but it is. It's very, very much in its own narrow band of expressivity. But I thought it was like halfway through, I'm like, what the fuck is this guy up to? And I'm like, well, you know, this album is like nothing I've heard in my living memory, and I can't really explain it. So I think it's worth talking about. You know, I want to talk about this record, but wow, yeah. And don't be, again, you know, you're going to see it and think this is going to be a worthy exploration of many cultures. And it's not that. It's not that. And of course, there's a whole song with all the lyrics are just, oh yeah. I don't know. It's like, there's more. Nope. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's like, I don't know. It's veering towards a kind of bizarre abstraction. There's something almost Kraftwerkian about it. I mean, it's nothing like Kraftwerk, but it's like, we're going to take the basic elements here of chord progressions and we're just going to think about them and we're going to sing, oh yeah, to them. What do you think of that? So that, I don't know that I've convinced you that it's something you want to hear again, but I'd give it a spin, people. See what you think. Don't do it under the influence of psychedelic drugs, because you will not come down. You'll join the Saturn people and we'll never see you again. So make sure that you're in comfortable conditions and that everybody knows your safe word and that, you know, everything's copacetic before you put this on. Anyway, that's my two cents. Well, are we ready for a vocalist?
Yeah, let's do it.
Says that there's a way to get ahead. Set aside your feelings, just repeat what's being said.
So, I not heard of this young lady. This is not her first album. It's Lauren Desberg, Out for Delivery, and she's straddling a mailbox on the cover. Saxophonist Braxton Cook, pianist Chris Bowers, drummer Jonathan Barber, guitarist Andrew Renfro, and electric acoustic bassist Ben Shepard and Russell Hall are the musicians here. And I think Eno, circa 1972, snuck into the studio on this one. I'm not sure, but there's some treatments going on.
A lot of treatments going on.
So what do you think of this? It's like a 30-minute EP, really, in a way. There's a number of tracks, but some of them are very short indeed.
Yeah.
Out for Delivery.
I thought the treatment was necessary, because without the treatment, she sounds uncannily like Norah Jones.
I knew that was coming. I knew it. Yeah,
I mean, goddamn.
I waited till I saw the sun. I don't know why I didn't come. Caught the train I never seemed to make on Monday. Someone gave me flowers and told me you're looking great. People all around me smiling in my direction. All too good, too perfect, tell me.
She has that same kind of almost too saccharine tone.
Well, it's an articulation thing. It's like this, I can't quite, it's like, there's a way that she pronounces certain consonants that have a, I don't know. I wish I had that. I'm sure speech pathologists would be able to explain it, but there's a, like, sibilance on certain consonants where you wouldn't expect them, or kind of a lazy tongue syndrome. And yeah, it's exactly like Norah.
Yeah, I mean, I have repressed Norah Jones' name, and I actually had to look up. I couldn't remember Norah Jones' name. So I'm listening to this album for the first time, and I'm like, oh, God, it reminds me of that. The one that Nellie McKay makes fun of, and I couldn't figure out. I know right. Nellie McKay's album's called Get Away From Me, and I couldn't remember what she was mocking, and I couldn't find it for the longest time. I highly remember. I finally had to recall the single. What was the single? I've actually repressed it again. What was the single? Something about...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Famous single, the Norah Jones single. I had to find the album by the single, and then I found her name. That's how... So anyway, yeah, Lauren Desberg has a voice that reminds me of Norah Jones. And no diss here, Norah Jones is a really fine singer. I'm not enchanted with a lot of what she does.
Don't Know Why, I think.
Don't Know Why, that song, for fuck's sake, yeah. So I think Lauren Desberg is as talented, if not more talented, than Norah Jones. I think she's got a terrific voice, but it's really smart to do the treatments. I think it's a really good idea to make this sound a little different, a little odd. So yeah, I actually enjoyed this. I thought it was really quirky. I thought it was fun. The treated vocals didn't bother me. The treated, it's like the sound has been kind of slightly, it's like the sound of the band has been put through an auto tuner set to slightly off key.
Or sometimes they'll like stick it underwater, or it just, it is reminiscent of what Eno used to do to Roxy music back in the day.
Yeah, and I like it. I think it's fine. It's clear that this is not really that much about the band. This is about her vocals and her delivery, which is unfortunate because I feel like the band is actually pretty good, but it doesn't seem like there's a lot of room for them. The really short songs here, Come With Me, Hold On, maybe to a lesser extent, Start Out Again. These felt to me like amuse-bouches. They were palate cleansers set into the middle of the album. So yeah, I actually thought this was pretty good. Probably my favorite cuts. I thought The Way You Feel Inside is pretty cool. I thought it was pretty funny. I enjoyed Come With Me. It's kind of a bossa Latin thing, except it's really short. You know, it's the one that turns to a phone call.
Yeah, right. There's a couple, and they all seem like those short ones feel like they could have been developed into 3-minute performances. She just chose not to. It's almost like they just cut off the performance. I don't know quite the thinking behind that, other than just short attention spans. I mean, for the audience, not for her. But
yeah, the earworm here for me is Something Wrong With Me.
Oh, yeah.
That really sticks with me. I really like that song. And then, you know, if you just want to get a, if you want to get a sense of what's happening here, like if you want to ask yourself, okay, would I like this album? Would I like Lauren Desberg and her approach? Just listen to the cover. I'm going to Sit Right Down.
Aww,
you know?
Yeah.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter. Sweet, they're gonna knock me off of my feet. A lot of kisses on the bottom.
It'll take you 3 minutes, and if you listen to it and you just say, oh my god, I hate what's happening here, then this is not the album for you. But if you listen to it and you're like, oh, that's kind of interesting, then get it. I like it. This is odd and quirky. She's a fine vocalist. I don't want to make it sound like she's not. She's very good. It's just that this is really highly produced and treated, and it's not going to be for everyone's taste. I felt like, and maybe it was good that we listened to this in the same week as Jared Gibbs, I felt, oddly, that this showed an enormous amount of restraint in the studio compared to Jared Gibbs. So, I have a generally positive response to this, and I'd be interested in hearing other stuff by her to find out if it's similarly produced or not.
Yeah, you talk about earworms a lot, and I would say that a couple of these songs did become that for me. You know, there's one about this guy, and, you know, he's struggling, and he had kids too young, and it's not my favorite on the album. I think I appreciate the effort at empathy. I don't know. It seems a little ultimately condescending, or maybe just a little callow. I mean, she's still fairly young, but not bad. I mean, not in a, like there's negative thoughts behind it or something wrong with it. Just, it's not my favorite of the songs, but mostly I think they're put together well. I think I'm assuming that she has written, again, you know, one thing you don't get with these promo materials is as much information on who wrote what. They typically don't tell you. They will typically give you who's in the band, but they don't necessarily specify, you know, where the compositions came from, aside from, you know, we all know that Sit Right Down and Write Myself a Letter to Fats Waller. But if she's the one who's writing these songs, I guess I'm assuming she is. I think she's pretty good. You know, I mean, the melodies are memorable. The words, I don't know, there's like fireworks in the language necessary, but they convey the message they're trying to give. They scan. They make sense. They hold together. They're good, solid lyrics with good bones, which is well above average. Lord knows the bottom goes a long way down. So, you know, I like them. I think that the band will get some hot solos off, but they tend to, for one thing, they're often fading out or treating the song aggressively at the end. And it is very much the sense of, You know, we're not at Billie Holiday where the band got 2/3 of the performance. This is like mainly about a pop song that then has some jazz interjection, some improvisation. And, you know, her own voice is flexible and she's putting some spin on her delivery. You know, I mean, what is a jazz vocalist? We've talked about that. I think I'm convinced that she has some creative delivery there. But it is about the songs. And of course, the more you're doing originals, the harder it is to detect any improvisation or departure of the singer because, well, how would you know that they're, you know, I mean, you've never heard it before. So how do you know if they're changing up what they're doing unless it's pretty extreme? Yeah, I thought the Fats Waller cover was charming. You know, they've got a kind of a highly articulated little background riff going on and she's singing it with just the right degree of lightness and it works. I mean, in general, I think that this is peppier, more driven, and sometimes more aggressively jazzy music than we tend to associate with Norah Jones. But I'd agree that vocally, she's just sounds a hell of a lot like her.
Yeah.
I think it's both range, and again, I'll try to put it in a clip here, but there's a certain way that she'll kind of schmear or just, I can't reproduce it.
You're right about the sibilance, and she kind of bites off vowels in a way that reminds me of Norah Jones. And I mean, I don't think it's imitative at all. I just think this is how she sings.
No.
And they happen to have a similar sound.
Right. I mean, exactly. I mean, her voice sounds like Jones, but her aesthetic, the way she puts together a record or a performance aren't necessarily that reminiscent of Jones. It's just that...
I'll just go on record and say I prefer Lauren Desberg by a country mile. And she's got a couple other releases out, and she seems genuinely interesting. I grab anything by her at this point on the strength of this album. Whereas if I never hear another Norah Jones that would be okay by me.
I know.
Well, not that, and, you know, and I feel fine about saying that because Norah Jones has more money than God at this point. So,
right. I got to say, Come Away With Me. I just, my brother very kindly got that for me as a jazz album. And I just remember halfway through thinking, does this ever end? I'm really bored. And I like some of her later stuff. You don't. But yeah, I mean, she's a problematic performer. For us anyway. And that, you know, whatever. Yeah, I really like this record. I strongly recommend it. It is almost an EP length. It's 30 minutes. And again, I feel like the songs that she runs out a minute or less or a minute and a half all sound like they could have sustained much longer performances. But in a way, she may have been thinking maybe it's just the way she prefers to do things or she's thinking about an audience that can get impatient quickly. I don't know. But they work. I mean, it's very much, this is an album. It's not trying to capture the pristine acoustic event. There's some manipulation going on, but I don't feel like it ruins it. On the other hand, I think I heard her in a club doing these things more straight ahead. I'd probably enjoy her quite as much. I don't know that it's dependent on those tricks, but we've run into this. Jamie Branch, for some degree, who I think is coming out with a new record soon, the trumpet player.
Right, Fly or Die.
Fly or Die, which, you know, got a lot of kudos, and I think very well-deserved kudos, though who was a little bit more problematic live at the Chicago Jazz Fest, I think in part because she was trying to play an album rather than a live performance. It's like, that's for headphones, this is a different genre. But she's doing that. We're hearing musicians comfortable with that manipulation, and I've got, obviously, both of us have grown up with that as, you know, in the pop realm. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. It's just, you know, how do you use it? And I always will love live acoustic music, too. I mean, I think there's something magic about that as well, but that doesn't mean there can't be the other thing. So, yeah, I like this a lot. I mean, it grew on me more than I thought it would. I can imagine just putting it on just for funsies, putting it on at a dinner party. But at the same time, both her lyrics and her thoughts and the musicians, there's content there. This is not a vapid pop album. I mean, it's ultimately an adult pop album, whatever that means, right? It's pop music meant for adults, not for clubbers or headbangers or whatever. You know, this is, it's in that genre. It's just, I think, perkier and more interesting and challenging than, say, a Norah Jones. All right. Well, overall, I thought this was happy. Again, I figured you'd not be pleased with Jerry Gibbs, but he's just weird enough. I'm like, we got to give this man a listen, man.
If you say so.
What's going on here? I got to know. Yeah, well, I'm, you know, probably a little more comfortable with that stuff, but it could not be my whole diet. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 166. For this episode, we've moved the Pop Matters discussion to after the bumper here, since most of it is devoted to kind of a long exploration of the question of morality and art, inspired by the recent reevaluation of Michael Jackson's work in light of a movie accusing him of rampant child molestation. So that's kind of raised the question of, can we listen to artists whose lives we disapprove of once again? And Mike and I weigh in on that. You're welcome to skip it if it's not your cup of tea. As always, you can download the podcast from www.jazzbastard.com, from Stitcher, from Mixcloud, from Apple Podcasts, and you can stream it on All About Jazz. You can reach us at mike@jazzbastard.com and pat@jazzbastard.com, or you can drop us a line on the Facebook page, or you can look me up on All About Jazz. Tune in next time as we do an episode devoted to Sarah Vaughan. It's been a while since we've done a one-artist podcast, and no one could be more deserving. Till next time, take care. Pop Matters before we get into our
I'm in the silly season of the semester, so I'm just keeping my head above water, so fire away.
And by the way, folks, there's a great Hall & Oates song about that, so listen to Head Above Water. It's one of their deep tracks. I'm not kidding, it's true. Okay, so I listen to a lot of stuff and I'm not gonna talk about it all. I did get to see Charlie Hunter at the Jazz Kitchen, and I'm hoping to put up a review of that in the next few days on All About Jazz. So by the time this podcast drops, hopefully I'll have something up about that.
I think I have an album by him, which is going to be the stupidest titled album ever, called Ready, Set, Django.
He's clearly a crazy guy. I mean, there's one with a gorilla on it. He's a character. He's this guy that plays 8-string guitar. He plays bass lines and guitar. And he's got this very cute...
He's good. I just hate the title of the album.
He's now doing duets. It's not really a duet. He had a local drummer there. And then Rob Dixon came in, the saxophone player in Indianapolis, on the last couple of numbers, and just tore down the house. But he's got this blues vocalist who sounds a hell of a lot like Joan Osborne and is, you know, really good singer. I mean, she's as good as Joan Osborne, which is, Osborne can sing, if whatever you think about her music. And they did a 90-minute set that was really a lot of fun. So I'll hopefully write that up in detail at some point. So anyway, I finally picked up Father John Misty's God's Favorite Customer.
Oh, boy.
And, it's only 40 minutes. I like it a hell of a lot better than his last couple of records. Mr. Tillman, and that's his actual name, is a Stone classic. I recommend that record. It fits into tonight's theme only because a lot of people, when they talk about Father John Misty, talk about his performative alter ego in the press and in talk shows, and how much of Father John Misty is a persona and how much of it is really him. I've never given a fuck about that stuff. Does the music amuse me or not? First album, I loved to death. The second couple, not so much. I Love You, Honey Bear, and I can't remember the third one. But
I like them both a little more than you did.
You do. The third album goes on like 70 minutes.
It's long.
The comedy, pure comedy, something like that.
Pure comedy. It's got two or three tracks on it that I just think are brilliant. But
yeah, it's a lot preachier, and this is just fucked up, Josh. I wish a couple of the numbers were quicker. I like the quicker numbers the best. But for Mr. Tillman alone, which is all about the desk clerk at the hotel where apparently he stayed 2 months to write this album, talking to him and then his responses, both sung, of course, by Father John. And it's great. I also dubbed Morrissey's album Viva Hate.
I've been listening to a shit ton of the Smiths lately. They've been in rotation quite a bit. So.
And God bless them. And this was Morrissey's first solo album. I remember getting it after the Smiths broke up. I remember listening to it, liking a couple of the tracks a lot, and never feeling particularly impelled to pick up another Morrissey album, which, from all I've read, was probably a fine choice. There's some, you know, Every Day Is Like Sunday is great. Suede Head is great. But this fits into the theme because one of the tunes, and at the time, as a just right out of college kid, I don't think the words meant anything to me. But there's a song on it called Bengali in Platforms.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I knew, I necessarily thought that Platforms were a kind of shoe or that Bengali was somebody from that nation. You know, it just seemed like a phrase to me. And I didn't listen to it much. It's not a very memorable song musically. But to me, it's an example of a song that when you know what it's about is intrinsically offensive. It's about, you know, he says, you know, you don't belong here. It's basically saying immigrants go home. And of course, we know from his career the last 20 years that Morrissey has some dubious political opinions and he is kind of anti-immigrant. But to me, that just kind of makes sure that you weren't missing something. The song itself is kind of racist. And so while I like the album okay, I don't think it's a patch on any of the Good Smiths albums. You know, that song kind of puts a sour taste in my mouth because it's about telling somebody who immigrated your country to go away. And I don't like that. So anyway, this leads into the big discussion of the night, which is I finally got around dubbing Thriller, my sister's old beaten up copy of Thriller. I talked about it a few months back now, probably. Both of us grew up in the time when that was just ubiquitous, inescapable, on the radio. It was obviously a mega hit, and he was on TV, and his dancing and all
that. How many number one singles came out of that album? Like
God,
five?
I know there were five big singles. I don't know if they were all number one, but it was just... And of course, now, I think at the time, and I'm still this way to some degree, but much more there, I was somebody listening to pop music for the persona, the ethos of the singer, and if that did not seem to match the content of the music... No matter the quality of the musicianship, I tended to reject it. You know, if it sounded insincere or campy to me, I didn't know what to make of it. I remember just hating Blondie's The Tide Is High
right. Because
that's a camp song. I mean, I don't mind it now. It's not my favorite. But at the time, I'm just like, this is not, and it wasn't supposed to be, anything genuine. I mean, Pink Floyd, they really were stoned. They really were worried about that wall. They might not have been the brightest guys on the block. But, you know, I mean, that made sense to me. And Michael Jackson, you know, when he's singing The Girl Is Mine, he says, I'm a lover, I'm not a fighter. I'm like, no, you're neither. It's pretty clear. So Jackson to me, I never got into that record. Now I much more appreciate the quality of the craftsmanship. You know, somebody described Billie Jean as just a song made up of nothing but hooks. There's like 20 hooks in that song. It's like, yeah, it's a very well put together piece of pop music. And I appreciate his ability as a singer, though, even now I'm like, yeah, some of this just sounds forced or strained, but I get it. He was hugely talented, but he was never important to me culturally. It was not my thing. I was not ready to appreciate him on that level. I don't know whether you were more into Michael than me.
No. I mean, I was aware of him as a, you know, how could you not be aware of him? But no, I wasn't like at that time or even since a huge fan, appreciative, but never a groupie or part of the
right cult. Because there is, I mean, a serious fanatic cult about him. Even
well,
now,
he's bigger worldwide even than he is in the States at
right.
this point. Yeah.
And there are people that, you know, because when this, the reason we're talking about this is the documentary that came out about him has sparked a lot of discussions among, you know, various outlets and people about, you know, can we listen to Michael Jackson anymore? If we really believed he molested these children... Which, I don't know, to me this is so bizarre because it's like, remember those trials? And he's like, he's an adult sleeping in the same bed with children. Is there any way you can spin that as okay? I mean, isn't that just, on the face of it, there's a problem here? But charges never stuck. People said that didn't happen. I don't know. You know, I mean, just to me, it just seemed obvious he had problems. I didn't know exactly what they were, but, you know, it didn't seem, and then... Somehow, I guess a lot of people, especially people who really deeply cared about his music, repressed this. And then this documentary came out with no new evidence, featuring people who had denied under oath that this had happened, saying it did in fact happen. And apparently it's very convincing. I've not seen it. I don't think I'll find time to see it. But then this raised the question, well, if he really was doing these horrible things to these people, should you listen to his music? And of course, if you think about jazz musicians, I love Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington was not a nice man in many ways. And he certainly, in the At Me Too era, my God, I mean, he is like the poster child for somebody exploiting his position for sex. I don't think anyone would question that. He was doing that all the time. I don't know that he ever forced anybody or raped anybody. I just don't know. But he clearly was using his fame and influence and power to get sex. And, you know, a lot of the musicians we listen to are drug addicts, etc. So I don't know. What are your thoughts about this? Can you listen to Michael? Does this change your opinion? What do you think about listening to the work of artists who we know were deeply, maybe criminally, morally flawed?
So what we're really talking about here is, does the moral standing or the moral evaluation of the artist force us to reevaluate or to think differently about the artistic achievement, right? So no one's saying that Michael Jackson is not a great artist. He clearly was. He's incredibly talented and produced some amazing things. And then the question then really becomes, is it possible to continue to appreciate those things and not somehow have one's judgment or one's appreciation tainted or warped by one's knowledge of whatever the moral shortcomings are of the artist in question. And so, you know, this just becomes an incredibly thorny and really difficult problem. And I think it's easy to get glib here. What I would really hate to do is I would hate for people to make, well, I can't speak for the people. I find it problematic to make quick and easy equivalences between the artist and the art. And I especially find problematic when we impose on artists from a previous time. This is not the case with Michael Jackson, but when we impose on artists from a previous time, the litmus tests of whatever evolution we've achieved on any variety of issues, be they racial or sexual or gender oriented or whatever form, wherever you are on the intersectional spectrum, whatever your agendas are, it makes me nervous when we start to apply those standards to artists, not just musicians, any artist from prior eras who aren't as evolved as, you know, we are or would like to think that we are. So that kind of makes me nervous. So yeah, you know, I've heard different versions of this argument sort of get played out, and I guess my own thinking on it is still evolving. But like, for example, I think I saw an interview on Colbert. I think I saw it on YouTube where Colbert interviewed Jerry Seinfeld, and interview Seinfeld. You know, when they first, the Bill Cosby thing had just happened, and he had just been sentenced, and Seinfeld held forth, I think, initially in the interview saying, well, it doesn't change the great comedy he did. And Colbert said, okay, well, Colbert said, I grew up like memorizing those records. You know, as a child, I memorized, like I lived Bill Cosby's records. And he said, I can't listen to them anymore, knowing what I know about him. And in the course of that interview, Seinfeld's like, okay, I think you changed my mind. I think you're probably right, which is kind of cool. I think it was kind of interesting. And I mean, I don't have a dog in the Bill Cosby fight, so I can remember listening to Bill Cosby and thinking he was incredibly funny, but I haven't listened to him in forever. And
see, the weird thing is like Rand, there's a period, and it's been a few years ago, where he got into Cosby, and I bought like 3 or 4 of the guy's albums used and dubbed them for him. And of course, this was before that broke. I mean, for me, Cosby, I think part of it is that his persona is of a wise humanist, and what he's selling you is his perspective on right. these events. And so it's kind of his take, his worldview. I mean, the comedians especially, right, they're selling you this package of, this is a way to look at the world around you and make sense of it. And so yeah, when you see that tainted as this guy who I can't even think my way into why he would do this, but there was a whatever the reason was. But yeah, when you listen to it now, you're thinking, well, is he so wise? Does he, you know, is his perspective tainted? And so to me, that makes more sense in some ways than, I don't know. To me, music is more abstract, I guess.
It's maybe, less, you know, I mean, I can, it depends on, comedians are a little, it's a little trickier because you're getting to the question of persona versus, you know, the actual identity of the artist. But I guess I don't have a huge problem separating the art from the artist and being able to say, I really like this art. I find the artists and the artist's attitudes about all kinds of things deplorable now. Maybe they were deplorable even in that time. Like, you know, pedophilia was never okay, right? But, you know, one
except
might
in ancient Greece, right? You know, I mean, there were cultures that more or less institutionalized it, but it's not right. I'm, you know, it's
right. So right. it's so Yeah, I don't have a problem separating the art from the artist. And I guess what I'm most nervous at, if other people don't have that, if they can't do that, that's fine. That's okay. I'm not going to force them to listen to Michael Jackson or watch Bill Cosby. They, you know, that's cool. I get it. Like if they can no longer appreciate this thing,
sure.
or no longer enjoy this thing because of what's been proven about the artist, fine. That's great. And I get it. Like I said, for me, where it starts to get really kind of hinky and nervous-making is when we take attitudes that we now have. We all sort of recognize gay marriage is okay now, right? And 400 years ago, that idea would have been kind of shocking for some people, perhaps. And people 400 years ago might have said things about, say, race or gender that we wouldn't accept. Are we going to subject those artists to present-day litmus tests? We're going to have to throw out a lot of things. You know, we're going to throw out Shakespeare. I'm not going to throw out Shakespeare.
Right. He was a monarchist. I don't agree with his politics. I got it.
Right.
I would go on. I don't think kings were divinely inspired.
Right. So there's a whole bunch of things that I'm not prepared to go there. And I really get nervous about those kinds of moves. Before the show, I was telling you the story about Kate Smith, incredibly amazing American singer who Irving Berlin kind of made a star out. And she's this amazing, huge-voiced actress. She was also famously profane. And all kinds of – she was a real character. Anyway, recently, one of the New York sports teams has said they will no longer play her rendition of America the Beautiful. She has a famous recording of America the Beautiful that, you know, God – or is it God Bless America? It's like, God Bless America. And they won't play it anymore because she recorded a couple of songs that had – there's no question, have just racist connotations. As I understand it, the particular songs in question were part of Broadway shows that the songs themselves are actually mocking certain racist attitudes. But, you know, the songs, they don't have happy titles. You know, I think the particularly offensive one is, and that's why God made darkies, right? So, you know, hey, it's just pretty fucking offensive. But if we're going to now banish Kate Smith, we're going to have to banish Louis Armstrong. We're going to have to banish all kinds of people who sang Sleepy Time Down South.
And of course, that happened with Armstrong, right? You know, there was a period certainly in the 60s.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
you know, people, when he was accused of being an Uncle Tom. And there's still some songs that, are going to – and I think absolutely, you know, if you, for whatever reason, have a visceral reaction, you hear a Michael Jackson song and all you can think of is pedophilia, then for God's sakes, turn it off. You know, it's not your duty
Michael Jackson
to listen
triggers
to
you, don't listen.
I mean, I guess I'd say that if you don't – if you feel like, I don't, and to me especially, it's when the person is dead, you know, like Ted Nugent, I've never listened to his music, but if I find his politics deplorable, I'm not going to want to listen to or buy his records because I don't want to send money to this guy. I mean, that's just a very pragmatic, however good an artist he is, I don't want to support what he's doing. But, you know, if the artist is gone, if you're not kind of voting for what they stand for by listening to them, then I think the question is, does it directly bother you? I think partially there is an anxiety. It fascinates me. I think it has to do with our resolutely ahistorical thinking. And it's the fear that if what we believe was not always somehow either believed or at least somehow intrinsically obvious in terms of morals or proper behavior, then there's this horrible feeling of uncertainty or what's anything based on. And so everybody should have known that it was wrong to be sexist or wrong to be racist. And it's like, no. That's just no. I mean, it's taken our as a species a long time to work these ideas out. And I frankly think some of it has a materialistic basis. I think that, you know, we get a lot more tribal and a lot more brutal when we feel threatened in terms of just do we have enough resources to survive? But and as we've gotten better at managing our resources, we've seen more and more. It's like, hey, you know what, individuals, maybe we can give everybody a certain amount of human dignity. Maybe we've got enough. And it'd be nice to think, well, that was always, you know, from the very beginning of humankind, that was always what we should have done or what we should have known or was always obvious. But it clearly wasn't. You know, I'm sorry, but
right. People
were not nice to one another for most of human history. And so it's like, I'm great. I mean, I believe those things, but I don't think their validity is based on the fact that they were eternal or obvious. I think it's that we've gotten here, we've had to fight to get here, and we're going to have to fight to stay here. If nothing else has been demonstrated the last couple of years, it's not a gimme. You've got to work for it. If you want to give humans dignity, that's an ongoing project. people will always benefit some people from taking it away. So watch out. It's not going to suddenly make it easy and everybody's going to do this automatically. But to me, if you expect or you get upset with somebody for believing what pretty much everybody believed at that time, you can say it's wrong. You can say we're smarter than that now, or we've got beyond it. But that's just, to me, incredibly short-sighted. I just think of yourself, what you're doing now, and how it's going to look in 100 years. Is everybody going to be a vegetarian? Possibly, yeah, I mean, you know, or whatever it would be.
The example. I would say, I use these kinds of examples in class with my students. I point out, think of all the things that you think now that are just perfectly obvious, that in 100 years, you will look like some sort of, you know, conservative troglodyte. Because in the year, 2119, of course people will marry their cell phones and their dog. They will have people who are married to their operating system and their kitty cat. And you will say to your grandchildren, I remember when marriage was between a man and a man, or a woman and a woman, not between a human and their pet and their dining room chair and their operating system. What the fuck? And people will say to you 100 years from now, oh, grandma, you're just so out of it. You know, I mean, just think about the things that we think now are just obvious that 100 years from now, people will say, and they believed that back then. Oh my God. You know,
and you know, and it may be that they were so effete and so worried when now we know it's just blood is the only, you know, we don't know where civilization may or may not have improved in 100 years. It may have gotten a lot more wretched, but exactly. I mean, it's contextual. And I'm just amazed by people that don't try to bring that to bear, that everybody is in a set of contingent circumstances. And most of us, the vast majority of us, are kind of looking around us for some kind of guidance as to what is okay. And obviously, we prize those people who are the cutting edge and stand for things that a lot of people reject, and fight for them and sometimes make them come true. But I think most of us would not stand up to that kind of scrutiny. So for me, if I listen to Billie Jean or whatever, I always thought there was something wrong with Michael Jackson. I mean, it just seemed pretty fucking obvious to me that he had some serious problems. I did not know exactly what or what he was not doing with children, but it seemed likely that he was doing something with them. Otherwise, why would you don't? There's nothing good about sleeping with a child. They kick, they spin. I've done it before. Why would you do that? I mean, it's just, if you can avoid it, don't do that, because they're a pain in the butt. They wiggle. So it just didn't make any sense. And again, I'm fascinated by this. There was this moment, and then everybody somehow forgot it. And I mean, it wasn't just these accusations. He just behaved bizarre. He made himself look like Diana Ross. He was a strange guy. But very talented. All that said, though, yeah, if this music or whoever's music, and I mean, again, I listen to Charlie Parker's music. It's fantastic. He was a liar. He was a drug addict. He stole people's horns and hawked them. He had a bad life, but I mean, he wasn't a great. I was thinking Aretha Franklin recently died. Amazing, uplifting performer. Not always a very nice human being. So just, I don't know where we go with this. I mean, again, most artists, especially those who have been around more than 50 years, held opinions or did things that we're not going to approve of. And there are neat exceptions to that, right? I mean, the people like Benny Goodman or even Dave Brubeck, who tried to have integrated music at a time when there was a real pushback against that. And of course, all the many, many African-American artists who play great music fighting that every day of their lives. There's a lot of things to look up to in the jazz community and the pop, But yeah, people did bad things. They did wrong things. And I don't know, to me, I guess I think of people as being very complicated beings who have a lot of facets, and hopefully most of us don't have quite such dark facets as Michael Jackson, but sometimes you're at your very best. I had a neighbor who told me, I like playing music because I feel like that's my best self. And it's like, yeah, I mean, sometimes that may be where all your best impulses go, and then the worst ones come out later or come out elsewhere. And most of us try to have more of a balance, but in some cases, yeah, you feel like this guy was communing with God, and then the minute he puts his horn down, Satan's back in his pocket, So I was like, well, what do we make of this? So anyway, just a thought. I've been fascinated by this discussion. To me, it's weird. I mean, I guess if you've just done historical work, you're going to spend time with people who you don't agree with. You couldn't study what we've studied if you could not handle reading the art of people whose opinions were vastly different from yours. Henry Fielding. I mean, I don't think we have a single thing in common. But the question to me is, does it kind of I don't know, taint the art? Does the art feel like it's pushing an agenda that you don't approve of? You know, Robert Heinlein, Starship Troopers, that novel's got some fascism in it. You know, it's
pretty much everything Heinlein writes has fascism in it. You know?
Some people, yeah, I feel like it does darken whatever they do or just make it repugnant to me, maybe not to somebody else, but I don't listen to Thriller and think any of that is about, I mean, Pretty Young Thing. But no, I think it's supposed to be about a pretty young adult. I don't listen to that music and think this is about that, even though he was doing that. Whereas, you know, if I listen to Bengalian Platforms by Morrissey, it's about his racism and I don't like it. Anyway, well, thank you for indulging me in this discussion. I'll probably put this one at the end after the bumper.
That's fine.